Buddhist Summer School, Wednesday afternoon, 29th August 1984. During the vast evolutionary span of the order of the higher primates, starting about 45 million years ago, their branching sequence can be presented under two major headings. One, the Platyrrhini, or the New World monkeys, mainly in South America. Platyrrhini because they had completely flat noses. And two, the Catarrhini, or the Old World monkeys of Africa and Asia. The Old World branch can be divided again into two groups. One, the Cercopithecoids, starting about 32 million years ago, and two, the Hominoids, from whom we hominids have evolved, starting about 23 million years ago. The superfamily Hominoidea includes the African apes, chimpanzees and gorillas, the Asian apes, orangutans and gibbons, and the Hominidea, that is, humans and their extinct ancestors who were not quite apes or humans. It is known that bipedal hominids, two-legged humans, were present in Tanzania and Ethiopia by at least 4 to 3.5 million years ago. 1.5 million years ago, Homo erectus, large-brained, approximate capacity 800 cubic centimeters, appeared and was the first widely distributed hominid species who may have used fire about 700,000 years ago and survived in southeastern and eastern Asia till about 300,000 years ago. Homo erectus was succeeded by archaic Homo sapiens, including the Neanderthalers, and modern Homo sapiens appeared between about 45 and 40,000 years ago, when anatomically modern humans appeared. It's very important to note this, because the anatomical structure means a different, when it differs, it means a different kind of apparatus for the transcendental energies which work through us. Now, the beliefs in survival after death, in spirits, and in gods and demons are extremely old, perhaps as old as archaic Homo sapiens. How did these beliefs arise? It may be that a man, big strong man, slew another man, perhaps for food or territory or the possession of a female or in anger and hate against an enemy. Later on, he saw the man he had killed in his dreams. In the dream state, one cannot kill. Limbs lose their strength, and one is helpless against the enemy. On waking, there is fear and dread. The person wonders, did I really kill that man? I'm sure I did at such and such a place and buried him and all the rest of it, or ate him up. So it becomes impossible to avoid believing that the slain man continues to live in a mysterious spirit form which cannot be hurt or destroyed. So, probably the belief arose that the spirit is immortal. And many men must have had the same experience. And thinking of it together, they came upon the idea that there is something which survives death and it is immortal and one cannot hurt it. Perhaps this may have been the origin of placatory rites and rituals and so forth. Man always tends to read himself and his ways of life into the creations of his imagination. Thus, spirits and the rulers of bands of spirits, evil and harmful or good and beneficial, and perhaps a supreme spirit, an omnipotent God, an almighty absolute ruler living in heaven, and the evil one similarly in hell, come into being. And just as the all-powerful chief on earth dispensed rewards to those who served him well and punished those who offended him, God and the good spirits on the one hand and the devil and the demons on the other did likewise. The 3-pound weight of brain stuff of Homo sapiens contains an immense invisible universe born of ignorance and fear. I am not suggesting that the only reality is the material world as cognized through our senses. Far from it. The Buddha himself repeatedly affirms in the Appanaka Sutta, though his logic really is rather questionable in that sutta, that there is indeed a world beyond. The actual transcendent is not an illusory fantasy of the ignorant and fearful man, because the actual transcendent is experienced by the perfected Holy One. Zarathustra was the first to propound the doctrines of an immortal soul, judgment after death, followed by heavenly joys or hellish torments for all time, resurrection at the end of time, and a complete renovation thereafter of the whole world. He just gave the hint. He just used those words, renovation, resurrection, and so on. He didn't spin out the doctrines that afterwards were spun out. During the 20 centuries after Zarathustra's death, Zarathustrian divines and priests had expanded this as follows. After resurrecting in their old bodies, now revivified, this apparently was a belief also held by the Rigvedic Indians in the very earlier stages, that immediately after death they reoccupied their body, revivified it, and were either in hell or the other place. So after resurrecting, there would be a final fiery ordeal through a river of molten metal, followed by a second judgment when all the unredeemed wicked souls, all the demons, hell itself, and the evil one will be entirely annihilated. On the other hand, the good earth will be renovated and become a veritable paradise garden, in which all good men in their physical bodies will live eternally in bliss, united with their wives and enjoying the presence of all their children and family and so on, experiencing marital union without having children and without needing any food for continuing to exist physically for all time. Charming welfare state. There is also an alternative version which says that a river of molten metal will completely purify the last remnants of evil in the wicked souls, so that all humanity, that is for them, all Zarathustrians, will live in eternal bliss. It's astonishing how carrots have always been held out to human beings to be good. But we human donkeys don't seem to pay for the carrots. Similar doctrines are found in all religions in some form or other. Zarathustra himself did not teach what his followers fabricated out of their imaginations. What he did teach, especially in connection with living the good life of purity in thought, word and deed, is of course of the utmost value, as in all religions. And it is on that point that all the religions are agreed. He also taught that evil doing produces sorrow and pain, and good doing leads to well-being and, in the perfect instance, to immortality. Here indeed were the seeds of the doctrine of karma propounded in Hinduism and Buddhism, and of divine justice in all monotheisms. It's strange that he was the first to bring all this out. Unfortunately, the monotheisms postulated an immortal, separate entity soul for each person. The context of the immortal is obviously the infinite eternal. You cannot chop up the infinite eternal and attach each little bit to each particular person, any more than you can cut up slabs of space and stick your nameplate on them. Hence, the term immortal soul, postulated as a separate entity, is self-contradictory and nonsensical, as absurd as postulating God as an immortal and eternal entity quite separate from and other than all else. It is this entity idea which is the mistake, and it has perpetuated itself to this day. Furthermore, it is this immortal soul which pays the penalty or reaps the reward for all that the existential psychophysical organism does during its life. And this penalty or reward lasts through all time. Far from being divine justice, it is utterly absurd nonsense. It is impossible for a finite mortal so to live that he produces an infinite consequence. If a mortal could live an infinitely good life, he might produce an infinite consequence. Or if he lived an infinitely bad life, he might produce an infinite consequence. But in that case, he would be either God Almighty himself or the very devil, because they are regarded as infinite. Even in Buddhism, which denies an immortal soul, we find again and again in the discourses the statement that after the breaking up of the body, he uprises in a good-born heaven till his merit is exhausted, or in a bad born, the downfall, Niraya, hell, Avicii, till his evil doing is expiated through terrible torments. Moggallana talks of how the Mara Dusin entered him and tormented him. All the religions have given descriptions of these torments in hell or transports in heaven, all of which descriptions are of the earth, earthy, supposed to be experienced in an entirely unearthly state of being. How is that possible? It's just completely impossible. Who or what is this he who uprises? The entire existential being perishes. Furthermore, it is taught in both Hinduism and Buddhism that you reap what you sowed. Is anyone so extraordinary that he is the exclusive source and the sole agent for whatever he thinks, speaks, or does? Innumerable factors, such as other people, one's parents, friends, teachers, upbringing, customs, tradition, changing circumstances, natural calamities, or favorable influences, have all played their part in producing each and every thought, word, and deed in each person. We live in a completely interconnected and mutually interactive universe. Modern science itself now has distinctly shown the fact of the total intercommunication and the interaction between everything throughout the universe. Thus, my thought, word, and deed is the result of everyone's thinking, speaking, and doing. I affect the world, the whole world, and both the world and I reap the results. The doctrine of karma needs a new and clear understanding and a restatement in a more accurate form. The old statement will not stand any longer. For one thing, in the subatomic world, causality doesn't hold. There is no such thing as causality in the subatomic world. I said last Saturday that whereas the Buddha did not find the means of salvation from bodily aging, sickness, and death, he did find something beyond all price, namely the true meaning of deathlessness and the noble eightfold path for its realization. We considered the meaning of deathlessness in that first talk, and I think I said something about it yesterday also. Today, let us consider quite briefly the noble eightfold way. I won't deal individually with the eight elements composing the Eightfold Way in detail, but I'll put some general considerations before you. It is called noble because he who discovered and taught it was of noble birth. The nature of the way itself is truly noble, noblest of the noble. And those who tread it are of noble nature, whatever their social rank may be by birth or occupation. It is practical wisdom to regard the eight constituents of the way as a unitary whole and not as separate steps on a prescribed route. On this way, you do not move from here to there, from youth to age, or from life to life. It is all here now, immediately, as a complete whole, a unitary whole. The way is in eternity, actually. Its spatio-temporal appearance is an illusory phantom, a continually changing phenomenon. The perfect thought, word, deed in each moment of our life spells the enlightened consciousness free of any limitation by space and time. As verbally stated, the first item on the way is perfect view, understanding, samadhi. This understanding is the knowledge of the world and man as they really are, namely characterized by dukkha, by anicca, and by anatta. Dukkha literally means badness, evil, suffering, imperfection. Anicca is translated as impermanence. But let us consider this rather carefully. Today we know of the conservation of mass and energy, which was unknown 25 centuries ago. Only the outward shape is impermanent. Form changes, but mass, energy is permanent. You cannot destroy matter. Matter is immortal. If you disrupt the atom, it is converted into energy, which is the exact equivalent of the mass of the atom. There is no destruction, no annihilation. It's a thought, isn't it? In short, matter is immortal. We are not yet actually conscious of matter as matter or of energy as energy. They are ideas, they are thoughts, they are words to us. We are conscious only of shape. That is the undeniable experience by seeing things. And this shape does change continually through time. So, our consciousness being thus limited, and our sense impression being what it is, we may say more or less that impermanence is true. Now, anatta is absence of permanent entity. Anatta is a Pali Buddhistic term not to be equated to the Sanskrit Upanishadic term anatman. The Tejo Bindu Upanishad affirms, and it's one of the great Upanishads which should be studied carefully, rest assured, anatma is a misnomer. There is no such thing as anatma. Conventional Buddhism has always ignored the real meaning of atma, which, as I said yesterday and I think day before too, is the exact equivalent of the Buddha's Vijnanam anidasanam anantam sabbato pavam, and has unfortunately stuck fast to the mannequin conception of the Atma, which is a misrepresentation of the Atma occurring in some of the later Upanishads. In his second sermon to the five, the Buddha dispelled some delusions held by various people. Some believed that rupa, the body, was the atta. Others believed that vedana or sanya or sankhara or vijnana was the atta. The Buddha taught very clearly, unequivocally, that no one should identify any of the constituents of the nama rupa, the existential being, with the atta, because each and every one of these constituents was liable to aging, sickness and death. Each and every one was impermanent, subject to suffering and mutable. None of these constituents had creative power. This was the important point which he brought out. And obviously the implication is that the atta as such, of which he would not speak, has this creative power, primordial creative energy creating. the constituents were neither self-existent nor self-subsistent. They were not immutable, but were born of karma, cause and nature. They were of little strength, comfortless, and constantly fading away, not to be mistaken for Apta. Majjhima, 3rd volume, page 30. But Akasa has been presented as an absolute, like Nibbana, for neither of them is born of karma, cause or nature. You'll find this in the Milinda Panhya, page 268. Akasa is both the limitless void and the conditioned fullness. This, as far as I'm aware, does not come in the Buddhist texts. It comes from the Upanishadic teachings. The matrix, it is the matrix of the universe from which all that exists is born by separation and differentiation. In the Chabbi Sodhana Sutta, the Sixfold Cleansing, third volume of the Majjhima, and also in the first volume, the Akasa Dhatu means element, is presented as the fifth element, the other four of course being earth, air, fire, water. It is presented as the void, intangible. The Buddha indicates that by the fading away, by the stopping of hankering for, and by the relinquishing of grasping after, anything which is dependent upon any or all of these perishing elements, the psyche is completely purified. Do not hanker after anything which belongs to the existential world. And the mind, hitherto imprisoned, is freed. And the freed mind is not dependent on any of the elements or on whatsoever proceeds from them. Note very carefully, this freed mind, you'll find this in the Dalai Lama's book, The Opening of the Wisdom Eye. Note very carefully, this freed mind is not impermanent, not created by cause. It is uncompounded and is immutable. It is the transcendent, unborn, unbecome, unmade, uncompounded. This is one meaning of Atta, the meaning of the Upanishadic Atma. And we must remember that this freed mind is not mine nor yours. Psyche is mine or yours. Each one of us, everyone has his own psyche as such. Nor is the freed mind anything other than the one universal mind. The pure holistic consciousness, Vijnanam Anidasanam Anantam Sabbato Bhavam, the all-enlightened, all-knowing, unitarily whole consciousness. Thus we can appreciate why the Buddha taught so insistently that all that comes within the purview of Vijnana of which we are conscious as separate things, persons, events, etc., is to be seen with unerring insight as anatta, not atta. When we do see so truly, our vijnana is transmuted. Now, this true seeing means being clearly conscious of it, not holding it as a thought or a belief or a conviction or an idea or anything like that, but to be clearly conscious of the thing, which quite transcends all belief, thought, etc. when we do see so truly, our vijnana is transmuted. All isolativeness and separativeness which darkened our consciousness is erased. Holistically conscious, we are at last fully awakened. The way, as shown by the Buddha, has become our natural way of life, and we inevitably live the holy life quite spontaneously. Whatever is your innermost consciousness is expressed through all thinking, feeling, speech, and action. And thinking, feeling, speech, and action also has its influence upon innermost consciousness. That innermost consciousness is, as the yogic people would say, the element of the absolute in you yourself, connected with the Sahasrara chakra. Such is the Brahmacharya, strenuous, unremitting endeavor from the very moment we begin to tread the path, deepens and clarifies our perception of the meaning and hence the practice of every aspect of the Eightfold Way. See, after all, the Eightfold Way is presented in words, in any language. Each of those words is interpreted by our own brain. And our own brain is very, very conditioned all along the line. And it's full of flaws and misunderstandings. If you say perfect view, for instance, perfect understanding or perfect action, and if you have 10 million different people, you'll get 10 million different conceptions presented by those people of the meaning of perfect action. So you see, to be completely conscious of what has been presented is the really important thing. And of course you do become completely conscious by practicing in the limited, faltering way that we do practice. Don't say it is so difficult to do this. So difficult is just doesn't really measure it. Of course it is difficult. It is supremely difficult. Can you journey all the way to heaven on a tapani ticket? Or buy a return ticket for threepence halfpenny? And Nibbana and its sublime peace is infinitely farther than heaven. Do you know why? Because it is infinitely near. Here now, right within, in the Atta. The entire existential being imprisons this Atta, this Nirvana, this bliss, this truth. And our inveterate self-conceit effectively prevents our seeing what we actually are. But let every clinging to the perishing existential burn away in holy sacrifice. This flame of sacrifice will not destroy or diminish the purified existential being one single jot. Instead, to use the words of the Buddha, routing the host of Mara, you will stand, like as the sun when lighting up the sky. This comes in the Mahavagga, you know, after the enlightenment, when he goes through those periods of meditation. The Buddha's third sermon, the well-known Sermon on Fire, is a presentation of the essence of the way. Masterly in its succinctness. Here again the Buddha states the fact. All the sense organs as well as the psyche, in this context the word psyche is preferable to the word mind, all the impressions received through the senses and all the sensations which originate from these impressions are all on fire with the fire of lust, resentment, and the delusion of separate entity existence. And hence, with birth, decay, death, grief, lamentation, sorrow, dejection, and despair. And seeing this clearly, being truly conscious of it, the instructed disciple of the Aryans turns away from, disregards, that is, becomes entirely indifferent to, and ceases to seek, or cling to, or set store by, everything that is on fire. Thus disregarding, he is divested of all desire. He is dispassionate, whereby he is freed. When freed, the unerring vision and knowledge arises in him. I am free. Ended is separative existence, jati, the conditioned state. Lived is the holy life. Done is what ought to be done. There is no further existence as a separate self for me. Na param ittaya comes in the Mahavagga 1:21-2-4. That means that as long as I am alive, I shall not be conscious of myself as an isolatedly self-conscious being, separate from everyone and everything else. When the Buddha had completed his 7-day long meditation under the Muchalinda tree, the wisdom tree, he uttered a solemn utterance on happiness. And his meaning of happiness is entirely different from ours. It belongs to the sphere of the infinite eternal. Ours belongs to the sphere of the finite temporal. He ended with the words, "He who doth crush the great I am conceit," meaning I am a separate being. This is happiness supreme. Instead of the word crush, it may be better to use the word transcend. When any holy one has transcended, all of them are... When any holy one has transcended the separative self-consciousness implied in the conceit, the fanciful notion, I am a separate being, he may well affirm, in unison with the great Upanishadic holy ones, Aham Brahmasmi, which is translated as I am Brahman. I wish the Upanishadic holy ones had said Brahman is me, instead of saying I am Brahman. The Buddha has been called the Lord of Compassion and Wisdom. It is very important and necessary to take note of his compassionateness and his teaching on compassion, especially in view of the austerity of his teachings and of the discipline he laid down for his disciples. Let us recall his words to Chunda and to a group of monks in the Salleka Sutta and in the Dveda Vittaka Sutta. Whatever is to be done from compassion by a teacher seeking the welfare of his disciples, that has been done by me out of compassion for you. Enlightened ones are free of sentimentality. Whatever sentiment they express comes out of a transcendent depth. It is wholly true and pure, and it is immeasurable, for it belongs to the context of the infinite eternal. The Buddha's compassion is divine love, creative, healing, incomparable. the transcendent cannot be adequately expressed in any language. But the Buddha's genius enabled him to express it in words which the people, not only of his own day, but also right up to our times, find quite comprehensible and inspiring. For example, here is a statement from the Buddha Vamsa. Be thou unequalled in loving kindness. Do thou suffuse friend and foe alike with loving kindness. And here is one from the Metta Sutta. As a mother, even with her life, protects her child, her one and only son, so let one cultivate a heart of love without measure towards all living creatures. And here is one from the Itivuttaka. Because whatever grounds there be for good works, all of them are not worth 1/16th part of that goodwill which is the heart's release. Goodwill alone, which is the heart's release, shines and burns and flashes forth in surpassing them. And here I think we have perhaps the supreme expression of the teaching of love. In the Kakachupama Sutta, the parable of the saw, we have the Buddha's instructions for training the heart. Because you should train yourselves thus, neither will our minds become perverted, nor will we utter an evil speech, but kindly and compassionate will we dwell with a mind of friendliness, void of hatred. And beginning with him who spoke an evil speech unto us, we will dwell having suffused the whole world with a mind of friendliness that is far-reaching, widespread, immeasurable, without enmity, without malevolence. And the Buddha ends that discourse by saying, because even if low-down thieves were to carve you limb from limb with a double-handled saw, yet even then, whoever sets his mind at enmity is not a doer of my teaching. The Brahmin youth Subha was conversing with the Buddha in the Jeta Grove in Anathapindika's monastery. Towards the end of the conversation, the youngster requests the Buddha to teach him the way to companionship with Brahma. And the Lord of Compassion gives the youth his teaching of the Brahma Viharas. I'll compress that, otherwise there's so much repetition. As to this Brahman youth, a monk dwells suffusing all four quarters of the world with a mind of friendliness, metta, of compassion, karuna, of soft, gentle joy, mudita, of supreme serenity, upekha. He suffuses it with a mind that is far-reaching, widespread, immeasurable, without enmity, without malevolence. This comes in the second volume of the Majjhima. And the Buddha adds, when, Brahman youth, the freedom of mind that is metta or karuna or mudita or upekha has been developed thus, that deed which is done in a limited range does not rest there, does not remain there. It spreads universally. In several discourses, the Buddha says that the monk enters the Brahma Viharas after the fourth jhana. It is the perfected Holy One who can effectively practice the Brahma Viharas. It's a tremendous technique. I've tried this myself, so I can only speak of my experience. All that one does is to go through a verbal ritual. May everyone be, all beings be happy, etc., etc. But that's just a verbal ritual. What power is there behind that statement? If oneself can enter the transcendent sphere of the infinite eternal, then there is a tremendous spiritual energy released which you can actually direct and produce real effects. Well, that's what I think. I may be quite wrong. I don't know. It is the perfected Holy One who can effectively practice the Brahma Viharas. To be capable of transcendent love like that of the Buddha, like that of the Buddha, one must be able to give oneself to the Beloved unconditionally, unreservedly, demanding, expecting, hoping nothing whatsoever for oneself.